Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Roger F. Pasquier, lifelong birder, associate in the Department of Ornithology at the American Museum of Natural History, and we're talking about his new book, Birds at Rest, The Behavior and Ecology of Avian Sleep. Roger, welcome back to the show. It's been too long.
Well, thanks. It would have been faster if COVID hadn't intervened.
Oh, God.
I work at the bird department in the Museum of Natural History. We had a lockdown on what are called non-essential staff for 2 years, and that interrupted my research and writing on the book we're talking about today, Birds at Rest.
Okay, that's an interesting point, because a lot of people I'm interviewing right now, their current books or projects were during COVID. It was like they didn't know what to do, and they did that. But you're saying you started this book before COVID.
Yes, I started the research on this in 2018 when the prior book, Birds in Winter, was out of my court, and I was just about finished with the research when March 13th came along, 2020, and happily, I've never had COVID. I love the lockdown because I was free to go birdwatching every day.
Yeah, that's what happened to me.
read the books that I wanted every day, see my friends outdoors every day. So it wasn't bad, except I missed keeping the momentum up on this book. But
thank God it's done now. And now this book is about such a fascinating aspect of bird behavior. Birds at rest, at sleep, or going to roost. All of that is covered in this extensively researched book. And for me, the behavior of birds as they're going into a roost is some of the most spectacular birding behaviors that we can witness in right here, like here in New England, you're in New York. But, you know, a huge group of starlings flying into a city roost under a bridge, or like tree swallows in fall going down into a salt marsh. Or I've been lucky enough to see chimney swifts migrating, big groups of them, funneling down some of these huge old factory chimneys. This behavior is amazing. How did you come up with the idea of putting all this information together?
Well, I've been interested in watching birds come to roost since I was a child, and hey, New York is a great place for that. We have chimney swift roost, starling roost, grackle roost, robin roost, but the real impetus came while I was writing Birds in Winter, because remember, birds in winter have to deal with extremely long nights. How do they cope with that, both energetically to stay warm, particularly small birds that lose heat very rapidly? How do they cope with that when there are so few hours left in the daylight to feed? And so I think the most inspiring moment came when I was reading about ptarmigan on the Svalbard archipelago, which is islands north of Norway that spend more than 22 hours in the depths of winter in their snow burrow. And I thought to myself, what are they thinking about? What are they doing there? And, of course, I had to write about a lot of other adaptations to winter nights. And that's what got me thinking about is there enough information and are there enough interesting features about birds, how they deal with night, sleeping, as well as going back and forth to the places that they roost, because, of course, in winter, many birds choose much more sheltered spots than they would need the rest of the year. So that was the real moment of inspiration.
Well, let's start off from the very basics, neurologically speaking. The functions of sleep in birds, is it the same as the function of sleep in humans?
Well, the more complex the brain, probably the more benefits that sleep provides. But there are surely a lot of the same ones for example, clearing out memory and experience that is not valued, just cleaning out all the circuitry generally, as well as giving time to think, and put this word in quotes, about some of the things that happened during the day or some of the motor aspects that you as a bird or a person needs. There's some recent research finding that birds go through some of the same neurological patterns at night while they're sleeping as they do when they are singing. They're not producing any sounds then, but this is perhaps the closest that anybody has come to whether birds dream or not.
It's interesting. Reading your book, it seems like although we do one big chunk of sleep, it seems that birds break it up into many tiny little bits. Like you write about the chinstrap penguins. Periods of sleep can even be a matter of seconds for them, so they can technically sleep 10,000 different times in a row.
Yes, I think that birds probably get as much sleep as we do, in fact, more than we do as modern humans living with artificial light, but it comes in a different form. It does come in bouts of several seconds or at most a few minutes, and this is an adaptation to the need for vigilance and being able to watch for predators that can come when birds are unaware.
Well, I've seen big scop flocks, and when you watch them, the birds seem to have one eye open and the other eye closed.
That's right. So so that's another adaptation that birds and a few kinds of mammals have, where they can shut half the one eye open, one eye shut is a reflection of what's going on in their brain. The opposite side of the brain is shut and sleeping, while the that eye is shut, and then they reverse every so often this halves of the brain that have sleep going on and the opposite eye shut. But ducks and other birds that live in large groups, the birds that are at the edges have been found to keep the external eye, the outer eye, open, and the reverse half of the brain open, because they're the ones, or that's the side from which danger might approach. The other interesting thing about ducks is that when we see ducks, most of what they're doing is sleeping and resting. So many kinds of ducks, particularly freshwater ducks, but perhaps also scop, are much more active at night than we imagine, because that's a much safer time for them to be feeding. So their whole rest cycle is reversed, particularly in the winter when they're not actively looking after the females, that is, looking after young who are out in the daylight.
Now, I want to mention to the benefit of the audience that every subject that we're talking about, there's so much more written about in this book. So we're just skimming the surface. I'm fascinated by the sleep posture of birds, the variety of sleep posture, like sleeping on one leg. There's a great drawing in your book of an ostrich laid out with its neck completely straight out.
Yes. So that's based on photographs, and they do that when they go into rapid eye movement sleep, which is something that both birds and humans and other mammals have. But rapid eye movement sleep is when the muscles are most relaxed, and that's when the neck, which might otherwise be curled up around their back or somewhat erect, that just flops. So that's a very brief form of sleep, but it does happen. While we're talking about ostriches, let me mention that most of what I learned about yawning also comes from ostriches, because back in the 1950s, there was a South African ornithologist who studied ostrich yawning and found that ostriches send a lot of social signals while they yawn. The leader of the troop, when it's a male, when he yawns, the others say, this is a sign that the coast is clear, we can relax too. Apparently, you cool your brain when you yawn. I haven't noticed it in myself, but ostriches do this. And a lot of other useful things happen while you're yawning. And, of course, it is contagious in ospreys, in ostriches, just as it is in humans.
Now, some birds sleep while they're perched. How do they not fall off the branch?
Because there's a locking mechanism that the, how to say this in words without a picture, that the more the leg bends, the foot bends, it's the tarsus, the more the foot bends, the more tightly the toes clamp around the twig or the branch that they're perched on. But a lot of birds that we used to think of as using this mechanism, now more close observation has shown that they're really just resting on the pad on the sole of their their toes, and they don't have to clamp that hard, but in a wind or something else that might move the branch, that's when the clamping mechanism comes into play.
There's a great drawing in your book of a blue-crowned hanging parrot.
Yes.
And that's how they sleep. They hang upside down.
Right. So this is believed to be because these parrotlets are so small that they're about the size of the leaves and the trees on which they feed. And if they hang upside down, they're obscured by the leaves because the leaves are sort of drooping. If they sat erect when they were sleeping, they'd stand out. But here they are blending in and covered by the leaves. And it may also have originated as a kind of muscular adaptation because they also feed at the tips of these branches by clamping onto the twigs while they are hanging down to reach fruit that otherwise would be inaccessible to them.
Now, other birds have other postures that they sleep in. One of those common ones that I see in waterfowl and in shorebirds is to tuck their head under their wings.
Yes, that's something that a lot of birds do. Probably more birds do that than anything else. And the interesting thing is that that has been found also in non-bird dinosaurs that are not ancestral to birds, but also have long necks and have been found fossilized in that very same posture. But the reason that it's believed that birds do that, and probably these dinosaurs did too, is that when you tuck your head back and into the feathers of your back, you are able to cover the bill and perhaps also the eyes and other parts that lose heat more rapidly than the feathered parts of the bird.
Now, there's so many things that affect when and how birds rest. You write about the midday rest in very warm climates. Birds will be active in the morning or just before darkness, but they need to seek shelter to get out of the heat of the day. Where do they seek shelter?
Well, in warm places, there's usually foliage. So a lot of small birds can simply be in a foliated spot. But one of the most amazing things was to find an account of one of this parrot species in South America, I've forgotten which one now, a flock of them went to roost in a cool cave.
Huh.
So they're on the lookout for these things in the same way that some birds at night are finding roost in glaciers in extremely cold places that are still warmer or more buffered from wind than roosting out in the open. But you mentioned birds in the heat of the day taking naps, as it were. That's certainly true, but even in the middle of the day in cold areas, birds are often taking a rest because, as you mentioned, they are feeding as soon as they wake up to replenish their fuel stocks after these have been depleted during the long and cold night, and then they need to refuel again at the end of the day to get through the subsequent night. But in between, particularly small birds want to be as light and agile as possible to escape any predators, particularly aerial predators. So at that point, they don't want to be stuffed. They want to be able to move in an instant and move as rapidly as possible. So that's why I think even if you watch birds at feeders, you probably see a lull in the middle of the day
right. When
fewer birds are coming to the feeder because they've already fed up in the morning and then they'll come back later before the day ends.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My return guest tonight is Roger F. Pasquier, lifelong birder associate in the Department of Ornithology at the American Museum of Natural History. And we're talking about his new book. It is just so crammed with stuff. We are just skimming a few sections of it today. It's Birds at Rest, The Behavior and Ecology of Avian Sleep. Roger, we were talking about birds in cold climates. Talk to me about hypothermia and torpor.
Yes. So hypothermia is the term used for birds when they drop their temperature by a few degrees at night while they are asleep. But this is particularly found in small birds because the smaller the bird, the harder it is to retain your high body temperature for long stretches. So many small birds like chickadees and other birds of that size lower their body temperature by a few degrees. This is something that happens mechanically. We don't think that there's any kind of mental switch that's doing this. Everything is in Celsius in ornithology now. So let's say they drop their body temperature by about 4 degrees at night, and then it comes back up before they wake up. Torpor is a deeper drop in body temperature, and the place you see this most extensively is in the tiniest birds, in the hummingbirds. Hummingbirds in cold climates, from the Rufous hummingbird in Alaska all the way down through mountains, and particularly in the Andes of South America, those tiny birds drop their temperature, body temperature, even more, and some very small ones are known to drop their body temperature to within 3 degrees Celsius of what the external temperature is. So that's going from, let's say, about 42 degrees Celsius, which is more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit, down to 3 degrees would be someplace in the upper 30s or low 40s in Celsius. So yes, this is one of the adaptations that small birds have evolved over millennia to preserve their body temperature or preserve their energy supply so that they can get through the night. And of course, when you think about hummingbirds that are living mainly on fructose and sucrose, that is not as long-lasting as right. the lipids that larger birds are eating, and that the fructose and the sucrose don't let them get through a 12-hour night as they would find in the near the equator in the Andes, as well as a fatter diet that other slightly larger birds would eat. So they have to be very efficient about lowering their body temperature to get through that long night.
Let's talk about what birds have to. I don't want to be anthropomorphic about this, but what they have to, what are considered where they roost, the elements there. They have to something that's going to alleviate the exposure to the elements, and that could just be a temporary, like it's raining out, and they don't want to perch out in the rain to roost. They have to be aware of predators. And this leads to a lot of strategies of birds, yes. of where they go.
So there's a balance between the birds that need to find shelter from the elements and the birds that need to find a place that is safer from predators. And for many birds, it's a compromise. But let's take one end of the spectrum. Let's take shorebirds that are feeding and then roosting on open mudflats where they're highly exposed. And particularly high tides, which are the times that shorebirds roost and cease feeding, they're looking for a place that is above water, but is also as far as possible from any concealing vegetation. So when you think of, for example, a salt marsh that then grades into a mudflat, falcons and excipiters particularly can sneak up on these birds flying low over the vegetation and pounce right down on the shorebirds. So shorebirds are looking for a place that reduces that, and some shorebirds, like Dunlins, have found that the only way that they can get far enough away from falcons during high tides, this is found on the Pacific coast and the Pacific Northwest and also been found in the wetlands in Germany, they spend a couple hours flying around in flocks out over the water a couple miles out at sea, because they're beyond the falcons, and apparently they have enough energy that they can do that, not using those high tide hours actually for a form of sleep, and come back when the tide is receding and be safe enough on flats that are sufficiently distant that they can see an approaching falcon. Going to the opposite end, the most sought-after roosts by small birds that sleep individually are cavities in trees, whether they're woodpecker holes or some natural cavity. And of course, there's a lot of competition for them. And there's some birds that bunk up together to use these, not because they're being generous to their neighbors, but because these create extra sleeping together in groups creates extra warmth that the birds collectively generate in a small place where the heat isn't dissipated in the open air. So those are the two extremes, the kind of inaccessible spot like a cavity and the birds that have to avoid any place that has danger at all. In between, you get a lot of birds that do roost in foliage or up against the trunk of a tree let us say, are hoping for the best. But some birds seem much less sensitive to cold, and the particularly larger birds, so that birds like crows and other birds that size roost pretty much out in the open, and for them, the roosting in flocks is the equivalent of finding a place that's concealed from enemies, because there are always some birds who have their eye open at any particular moment and can alert the entire group to any danger that's approaching.
This, you brought up the subject of Dunlin flying out over the ocean. One of the subjects covered in this book is the possibility of aerial roosting or aerial sleeping, particularly in swifts.
Yes. So
is that absolutely been proven in the natural environment that the swifts are just going up and sleeping high?
Yes. Yes. Radar and other mechanisms have found that, and you know, pilots during the First and Second War flying over Europe. This is best known from the European swift. So definitely not our local chimney swifts, which, as we know, roost in chimneys. But, pilots found them up at high elevations when they were flying at night. Back in the 18th century, Gilbert White in England was the first to speculate on what these birds do. And now there are enough radar studies to show that they are up there going up. Again, we're talking in meters, so low thousands of meters, 1,000 meters up, that would be about 3,000 feet, are going up there. And if you're ever in Europe, you can see during the seasons that swifts are there, them rising higher and higher at dusk until they're completely out of sight. But the radar has found that they get up to a certain elevation, then start sort of circling and gliding around and somewhat drifting downward, and towards morning, long before there is actual light, they go up again, and then when light first comes, they're up quite high, and they can get their bearings so that they can see, have they drifted from their home colony, and because the ones that are up there include adult males that are coming back to feed their young at the nest, so they can't lose sight of where they're meant to be based. But yes, that's been found in several species of Eurasian swifts now, and most recently in the black swift when it winters in Amazonian Brazil.
Now, is something happening to their oxygen intake while they're sleeping so high up?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that anybody is measuring that or has measured that in swifts. The challenge with swifts is that they're awfully hard to retrieve. If you can put the different devices on them that would measure whether they are actually in sleep or forms of their brain or not, and what their heart rate is, all of these things are very difficult to retrieve from swifts. So that's why some of the best work on sleep in flight has been done on frigate birds. The work was done in the Galapagos and other islands where they were able to affix these various devices to birds at their nest. Then the females and the males rotate several days at the nest. The vacating parent goes off and feeds over the ocean for several days or weeks during the non-breeding season. But during the breeding season, they come back to the nest. They're very tame, and you can take the equipment off and measure their heart rate, measure what's going on in their brain, all of those things. So from that, we do know that frigate birds do actually go into low-wave sleep some of the time when they're riding on thermals high over warm water oceans.
There's so much more we could talk about that's written about in this book, but we're running out of time. I just want to pay attention to human disturbance of roosting birds and what a critical problem that is.
Yes. So here in cities, when flocks of starlings, flocks of crows, even flocks of pigeons roost on buildings, they make a mess. So they're not very welcome. And some roosts that I used to watch as a child are no longer used by starlings because they've simply been driven off. In other parts of the world, large numbers of birds, even small birds like swallows, are still a valued source of food for local peoples, and they are caught there. In other places like Venezuela, where huge flocks of dick thistles roost in crops, the birds are persecuted because they, during the daytime, they're eating the seeds of these crops. So human persecution is a problem, but you know, it's not as serious or as widespread a problem as some other things that birds are exposed to at night that are long-term dangers thanks to people.
Well, I was thinking of birds that are roosting on beaches, like gulls, shorebirds. People sometimes run purposely their dogs, or they think it's sort of fun to flush them all up. That's costing the birds.
That's right. So, yes, that's another problem, particularly for birds during the daytime rather than the night examples that I've been giving you. Yes, the birds that roost at high tide, like shorebirds, on beaches, there are fewer and fewer beaches that are that are protected from people and their dogs and their cars. And now there are more and more beaches that are being used all over the world during more and more times of the year with more and more affluence. People are now on beaches on holidays in the southern areas that shorebirds are migrating to during the winter. But remember that most shorebirds, since we're talking about Massachusetts here, are passing through Massachusetts during July and August, the peak of the beach season. It's hard for those birds to find a protected spot to roost during high tide.
We're completely out of time. Like I mentioned, we could have talked about this book for hours and hours and just scratched the surface. My returning guest tonight is Roger F. Pasquier, lifelong birder, associate in the Department of Ornithology at the American Museum of Natural History. And we're talking about his fascinating new book. You'll find tons to be fascinated by. Birds at Rest: The Behavior and Ecology of Avian Sleep. Roger, as usual, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.